Chapter 7, Joyous Body, The Wild Flesh. I have been taken with the way wolves hit their bodies together when they run and play. The old wolves in their way, the young ones in theirs, the skinny ones, the fat ones, the long-legged, the lop-tailed, the floppy-eared, the one whose broken limbs healed crookedly. They all have their own body configurations and strengths, their own beauty. They live and play according to what and who and how they are. They do not try to be what they are not. Up in the Northlands, I watched one old wolf who had only 3 legs. She was the only one who could fit through the crevice where the blueberries were branching. I saw a grey wolf crouch and leap in such a flash it left the image of silver in the air for a second afterwards. I remember a delicate one, a new mother, still fulsome in the belly, picking her way through the pool moss with the grace of a dancer. Yet despite their beauty and ability to stay strong, wolves are sometimes talked about in this way. Ah, you are too hungry, your teeth are too sharp, your appetite's too interested. Like wolves, women are sometimes discussed as though only a certain temperament, only a certain restrained appetite is acceptable. And too often added to that is an attribution of moral goodness or badness according to whether a woman's size, height, gait, or shape conform to a singular or exclusionary ideal. When women are regulated to moods, mannerisms, and contours that conform to a single ideal of beauty and behaviour, they are captured in both body and soul and are no longer free. In the instinctive psyche, the body is considered a sensor, an informational network, a messenger with myriad communication systems, cardiovascular, respiratory, skeletal, autonomic, as well as emotive and intuitive. In the imaginal world, the body is a powerful vehicle, a spirit who lives with us, a prayer of life in its own right. In fairy tales, as personified by magical objects that have superhuman qualities and abilities, the body is considered to have 2 sets of ears, one for hearing in the mundane world, the other for hearing the soul, 2 sets of eyes, one set for regular vision, another for far-seeing, 2 kinds of strength, the strength of the muscles and the invisible strength of the soul. The list of twos about the body goes on. In systems of bodywork such as Fledrikler's method, Ayurveda and others, the body is understood variously as having 6 senses, not 5. The body uses its skin and deeper fascia and flesh to record all that goes on around it. Like the Rosetta Stone, for those who know how to read it, the body is a living record of life given, life taken, life hoped for, life healed. It is valued for its articulate ability to register immediate reaction, to feel profoundly, to sense ahead. The body is a multilingual being. It speaks through its colour and its temperature, the flush of recognition, the glow of love, the ash of pain, the heat of arousal, the coldness of non-conviction. It speaks through its constant tiny dance, sometimes swaying, sometimes a jitter, sometimes trembling. It speaks through the leaping of the heart, the falling of the spirit, the pit at the centre and rising hope. The body remembers, the bones remember, the joints remember, even the little finger remembers. Memory is lodged in pictures and feelings in the cells themselves. Like a sponge filled with water, anywhere the flesh is pressed, wrung, even touched lightly, a memory may flow out in a stream. To confine the beauty and value of the body to anything less than its magnificence is to force the body to live without its rightful spirit, its rightful form, its right to exaltation. To be thought ugly or unacceptable because one's beauty is outside the current fashion is deeply wounding to the natural joy that belongs to the wild nature. Women have good reason to refute psychological and physical standards that are injurious to spirit and which sever relationship with the wild soul. It is clear that the instinctive nature of women values body and spirit far more for their ability to be vital, responsive, and enduring than any measure of appearance. This is not to dismiss who or what is considered beautiful by any segment of culture, but to draw a larger circle that embraces all forms of beauty, form, and function. A friend and I once performed a tandem storytelling called Body Talk, about discovering the ancestral blessing of our kith and kin. Apalasia is an African-American griot, and she is very tall, like a yew tree, and is just as slender. I am una Mexicana, and I am built close to the ground, and am of extravagant body. In addition to being mocked for being tall, as a child, she was told that the split between her front teeth was a sign of being a liar. I was told that my body shape and size were the signs of being inferior and of having no self-control. In this concurrent telling about body, we spoke of the slings and arrows we received throughout our lives because, according to the great they, our bodies were too much of this and not enough of that. In our telling, we sang a mourning song for the bodies we were not allowed to enjoy. We rocked, we danced, we looked at each other. We were each thinking the other is so mysterious looking in such a beautiful way. How could anyone have thought otherwise? How amazed I was to hear that as an adult, she had journeyed to the Gambia in West Africa and found some of her ancestral people, who, lo, had among their tribe many people who were very tall, like yew trees, and just as slender, and who had splits between their front teeth. This split, they explained to her, was called Sakaya Yala, meaning opening of God, and it was understood as a sign of wisdom. How surprised she was when I told her that, as an adult, I had journeyed to Isthmus of in Mexico, and found some of my ancestral people who, lo, were a tribe with giant women who were strong, flirtatious, and commanding in their size. They had patted me and plucked at me, boldly remarking that I was not quite fat enough. Did I eat enough? Had I been ill? I must try harder, they explained, for women are la tierra, made round like the earth herself, for the earth holds so much. So in the performance, as in our lives, our personal stories, which began as experiences both oppressive and depressive, end with joy and a strong sense of self. Opalanja explains that her height is her beauty, her smile is one of wisdom, and that the voice of God is close to her lips. I understand my body as not separate from the land, that my feet are made to hold my ground, my body a vessel made to carry much. We learn from powerful people outside our own United States culture to revalue the body, to refute ideas and language that may revile the mysterious body, and that would ignore the female body as an instrument of knowing. To take much pleasure in a world filled with many kinds of beauty is a joy in life to which all women are entitled. To support only one kind of beauty is to be somehow unobservant of nature. There cannot be only one kind of songbird, only one kind of pine tree, only one kind of wolf. There cannot be one kind of baby, one kind of man, or one kind of woman. There cannot be one kind of breast, one kind of waist, one kind of skin. My experiences with women of size in Mexico caused me to question the entire set of analytic premises about women's various sizes and shapes, and especially weights. One old psychological premise in particular seemed grotesquely erroneous. The idea that all women of size are hungry for something, that inside them is a thin person screaming to get out. When I suggested this thin, screaming woman metaphor to one of the majestic Tejana tribeswomen, she peered at me somewhat alarmed. Did I mean possession by an evil spirit? Who would have put an evil thing inside a woman? She asked. It was beyond her comprehension that a woman could be considered by healers or anyone else to have a screaming woman within her because she was naturally big. While compulsive or destructive eating disorders that distort body size and body image are real and tragic, they are not the norm for most women. Women who are big or small, wide or narrow, short or tall, are most likely to be so simply because they inherited the body configuration of their kin. If not their immediate kin, then those a generation or two back. To malign or judge a woman's heritage, inherited physicality is to make generation after generation of anxious and neurotic women. To make destructive and exclusionary judgment about a woman's inherited form robs her of several critical and precious psychological and spiritual treasures. It robs her of pride in the body type that she has been given by her own ancestral lines. If she is taught to revile this body inheritance, she is immediately slashed away from her female body identity with the rest of her family. If she is taught to hate her own body, how can she love her mother's body that was the same configuration as hers, her grandmother's body, the bodies of her daughters as well? How can she love the bodies of other women and men close to her who have inherited the body shapes and configurations of their ancestors? To attack a woman thusly destroys her rightful pride of affliction with her own people and robs her of the natural lilt she feels in her body, no matter what height, size, shape she is. In essence, the attack on women's bodies is a far-reaching attack on the ones who have gone before her, as well as the ones who will come after her. Instead, harsh judgments about bodies... Instead, harsh judgments about body acceptability create a nation of hunched-over tall girls, short girls on stilts, women of size dressed as though in mourning, very slender women trying to puff themselves out like adders, and various other women in hiding. Destroying a woman's instinctive affliction with her natural body cheats her of confidence. It causes her to perseverate about whether she is a good person or not, and bases her self-worth on how she looks instead of who she is. It pressures her to use up her energy worrying about how much food she consumes or the readings on the scale and tape measure. It keeps her preoccupied, colours everything she does, plans, and anticipates. It is unthinkable in the instinctive world that a woman should live preoccupied by appearance in this way. It makes utter sense to stay healthy and strong, to be as nourishing to the body as possible. Yet, I have to agree, there is in many women a hungry one inside. But rather than hungry to be a certain size, shape, height, rather than hungry to fit the stereotype, women are hungry for basic regard for the culture surrounding them. The hungry one inside is longing to be treated respectfully, to be accepted, and in the very least, to be met without stereotyping. If there really is a woman screaming to get out, she is screaming for a cessation of the disrespectful projections of others onto her body, her face, her age. The pathologizing. I'm not being able to read today very well, sorry. The pathologizing of variation in women's bodies is a deep bias endorsed by many psychological theorists, most certainly by Freud. For instance, in his book on his father, Sigmund, Martin Freud relates how the entire body actively disliked and ridiculed stout people. The reasons for Freud's views are beyond the scope of his work. However, it is difficult to understand how much of an attitude would assist a balanced viewpoint towards women's bodies. Yet, suffice it is to say that various practitioners of psychology continue to hand down this bias against the natural body, encouraging women to turn their attention to a constant monitoring of the body, thereby robbing them of deeper and finer relationships with their given form. Angst about the body robs a woman in some large share of her creative life and her attention to other things. This encouragement to begin trying to carve her body is remarkably similar to the carving, burning, peeling off layers, stripping down to the bone, the flesh, of the earth itself. Sorry, I didn't read that very well. Let me do it again. because this is important bit. This encouragement to begin trying to carve her body is remarkably similar to the carving, burning, peeling off layers, stripping down to the bones, the flesh of the earth itself. Where there is a wound on the psyches and bodies of women, there is a corresponding wound at the same site in the culture itself, and finally, on nature herself. In a true holistic psychology, all worlds are understood as interdependent, not as separate entities. It is not amazing that in our culture there is an issue about carving up a woman's natural body, that there is a corresponding issue about carving up the landscape, and yet another about carving up the culture into fashionable parts as well. Although a woman may not be able to stop the dissection of the culture and lands overnight, she can stop doing so to her own body. The wild nature would never advocate the torture of the body, culture, or land. The wild nature would never agree to flog the form in order to prove worth, prove control, prove character, be more visually pleasing, more financially valuable. A woman cannot make the culture more aware by saying change, but she can change her own attitude towards herself, thereby causing devaluing projections to glance off. She does this by taking back her body, by not forsaking the joy of her natural body, by not purchasing the popular illusion that happiness is only bestowed on those of a certain configuration or age, by not waiting or holding back to do anything, and by taking back her real life and living it full bore, all stops out. This dynamic self-acceptance and self-esteem are what begins to change attitudes in the culture. The body in fairy tales. There are many mythos and fairy tales that describe the frailties and the wildness of the body. There is Greek Hephaestus, the lame worker of precious metals, the Mexican Harter, a double-bodied one, Venus born of the sea, the littlest tailor, who was ugly but could create new life, the women of giant mountains, who were courted for their strength, Thumbelina, who is able to travel about magically, and many more. In fairy tales, certain magic objects have transportive and sensory abilities that are apt metaphors for body, such as magic leaf, magic carpet, cloud. Sometimes cloaks, shoes, shields, hats, and helmets give the power of invisibility, superior strength, far vision, and so forth. There are archetypal kith and kin. Each enables the physical body to enjoy deepened insight, hearing, flight, or protection of some sort for both psyche and soul. Before the invention of carriages, coaches, chariots... Sorry, I read that so weird. Before the invention of carriages, coaches, chariots, before the domestication of animals for hauling and riding, it appears the motif that... Sorry, I've got giggles... It appears the motif that represented the sacred body was the magical object. Articles of clothing, amulets, talismans, and other objects, when related to in a certain way, transported the person across the river or the world. The magic carpet is an excellent symbol of the sensory and psychic value of the natural body. Fairy tales, in which the flying carpet motifs appear, mimic the not very conscious attitudes towards body in their own culture. The magic carpet is at first thought to be quite ordinary and without much value, but for those who seat themselves in its dense pile and say, "Arise," the carpet instantly trembles, rises a bit, hovers, and then zoom, away it flies, transporting the rider to a different place, centre, viewpoint, knowing. The body, through its states of arousal, awareness, and sensory experiences, such as listening to music, for instance, or hearing a loved one's voice, or smelling certain fragrance, has the ability to transport us anywhere. In fairy tales, as in mythos, the carpet signifies a form of locomotion, but of a certain kind, the kind that enables us to see into the world and into the underlife as well. In the Middle Eastern stories, it is the vehicle for spirit flight of the shamans. The body is no dumb thing from which we struggle to free ourselves. In proper perspective, it is a rocket ship, a series of atomic clover leaves, a tangle of neurological umbilicae to other worlds and experiences. In addition to the magic carpet, there are other symbols for the body. One story in particular illustrates this. This tale was given to me by Futa Kelly. It is called simply The Tale of the Magic Carpet. In it, a sultan sent... A sultan sends his three brothers to... I think it might be sultan. Anyway, sends his three brothers to search for the finest object on earth. Whichever brother is deemed to have found the ultimate treasure will win an entire kingdom. One brother searches and brings back an ivory wand through which one can see into whatever one wishes. One brother brings back an apple whose smell can cure any affliction. The third brother brings back a magic carpet that can transport a person anywhere simply by his thinking of the place. So, which is greater? Asks the sultan. The ability to see far, the ability to heal and recover, or the ability for spirit flight. By turn, each brother glories the object in his hand. Yet, the sultan finally waves his hand and proclaims, none of these is greater than the other, for without one, the others would be of no use, and the kingdom is given in equal shares to each brother. Embedded in this tale are potent images that allow us to imagine what a true aliveness of the body really is. This tale, and others like it, describe the fabulous powers of intuition, insight, sensory healing, and the rapture hidden in the body. We tend to think of the body as this other that does its thing somewhat without us, and that if we treat it right, it will make us feel good. Many people treat their bodies as if the body is a slave, or perhaps they even treat it well, but demand it follows their wishes and whims as though it were a slave nonetheless. Some say the soul informs the body. But what if we were to imagine for a moment that the body informs the soul, helps it to adapt to mundane life, passes, translates, gives the blank page, the ink and the pen with which the soul can write upon our lives? Suppose, as in a fairy tale of the shape changes, the body is a god in its own right, a teacher, a mentor, a certified guide. Then what? Is it wise to spend a lifetime chastising this teacher who has so much to give and teach? Do we wish to spend a lifetime allowing others to detract from our bodies, judge them, find them wanting? Are we strong enough to refute the party line and listen deep, listen true to the body as a powerful and holy being? The idea in our culture of body solely as scripture is wrong. The idea in our culture of body solely as sculpture is wrong. Body is not marble. It is not its purpose. Its purpose is to protect, contain, support, and fire the spirit and soul within, to be responsatory for memory, to be a repository for memory, to fill us with feeling. That is the supreme psychic nourishment. It is to lift us and propel us, to fill us with feeling to prove that we exist, that we are here, to give us grounding, heft, weight. It is wrong to think of it as a place we leave in order to soar to the spirit. The body is the launcher for those experiences. Without the body, there would be no sensations of crossing thresholds. There would be no sense of lifting, no sense of height, weightlessness. All that comes from the body. The body is the rocket launcher. In its capsule, the soul looks out the window into the mysterious starry night and is dazzled. What constitutes a body in the instinctual world? At the most basic level, the breast, the belly, anywhere there is skin, anywhere there are neurons to transmit feeling, the issue is not what shape, what size, what colour, what age, but it does feel. Does it work? But does it feel? Does it work as it is meant to? Can we respond? Do we feel a range, a spectrum of feeling? Is it afraid, paralysed by pain or fear, unetherized by old trauma? Or does it have its own music? Is it listening, like Baobo, through the belly? Is it looking with its many ways of seeing? I had two watershed experiences when I was in my early 20s, experiences that went against everything I had been taught about my body up until then. While at a woman's week-long gathering, and at a night at the fire near the hot springs, I saw a naked woman of about 35. Her breasts were emptied out by childbearing, her body satiated by birthing children. Strated from birthing children. I was very young and I remember feeling sorry for the assaults on her fair and thin skin. Someone was playing maracas and drums and she began to dance. Her hair, her breasts, her skin, her limbs, all moving in different directions. How beautiful she was. How vital. Her grace was heartbreaking. I had always smiled at that phrase, fire in her loins, but that night I saw it. I saw the power in her haunches. I saw what I had been taught to ignore, the power of a woman's body when it is animated from the inside. Almost 3 decades later, I can see her dancing in the night, and I am still struck by the power of body. The second awakening involved a much younger woman. Her hips were, according to the common standard, too pear-shaped. Her bosom very tiny in comparison, and she had thin purpley veins all over her thighs, a long scar from a serious surgery going around her body from the rib cage to spine, in the manner in which apples are peeled. Her waist was perhaps 4 hands wide. It was a mystery, then, why the men buzzed about her as though she was a honeycomb. They wanted to take a bite out of her pear thighs. They wanted to lick that scar, hold that chest, lay their cheeks upon her spidery veins. Her smile was dazzling. Her gait was beautiful. And when her eyes looked, they truly took in what they were looking at. I saw again what I had been taught to ignore, the power in the body. The cultural power of the body is its beauty, but the power in the body is rare, for most have chased it away with their torture of or embarrassment by the flesh. It is in this light that the wildest woman can inquire into numinosity of her own body and understand that it is not as a dumbbell that we are sentenced to carry for life, not as a beast of burden, pampered or otherwise, who carries us around for life, but a series of doors and dreams and poems through which we can learn and know all manner of things. In the wild psyche, body is understood as being its own right, one who loves us, depends on us, one to whom we are sometimes mother, and who sometimes is mother to us. La mariposa. La mariposa. Butterfly woman. To tell you about the power of the body is in another way, I have to tell you a story. A true, rather long story. Trust me, this one is rather long. For years, tourists have thundered across the great American desert, hurrying through the spiritual circuit. Monument Valley, Cacao Canyon, Mesa Verde, Kayenta, Keem's Canon, Painted Desert, and Canyon de Chelly. They peer up the pelvis of the Mother Grand Canyon, shake their heads, shrug their shoulders, and hurry home again, only to come charging across the desert next summer, looking some more, watching some more. Underneath it all is the same hunger for the numinous experience that humans have had since the beginning of time. But sometimes this hunger is exacerbated, for many people have lost their ancestors. They often do not know the names of those beyond their grandparents. They have lost, in particular, the family stories. Spiritually, this situation causes sorrow and hunger. So many are trying to recreate something important for soul's sake. For years, tourists have come also to Puye, a big dusty mesa in the middle of nowhere, New Mexico. Here, Anasazi, the ancient ones, once called to each other across the mesas. A prehistoric sea, it is said, carved thousands of grinning, leering and moaning mouths and eyes into the rock walls here. The Dine, oh my god, this is so many words I can't pronounce. Jikaria Apasha, Southern Ute, Hopi, Zuni, Santa Clara, Santo Domingo, Lagana, Perusius. All these desert tribes come together here. It is here they dance themselves back into the lodgepole pine trees, back into deer, back into eagles, powerful spirits. And here too come visitors, some of whom are very starved of their genomyths, detached from the spiritual placenta. They have forgotten their ancient gods as well. They come to watch the ones who have not forgotten. The road up to Puye was built for horses' hooves and moccasins, but over time automobiles became more powerful, and now locals and visitors come in all manner of cars, trucks, convertibles and vans. The vehicles all whine and smoke up the road in a slow, dusty parade. Everyone parks nilly-willy on the lumpy hillocks. By noon, the edge of the mesa looks like a 1,000-car pile-up. Some people park next to 6-foot-tall hollyhocks, thinking they will just knock over the plants to get out of their car. But the 100-year-old hollyhocks are like old iron women. Those who park next to them are trapped in their cars. The sun turns into a fiery furnace by midday. Everyone trudges in hot shoes, burdened with an umbrella in case it rains, it will, an aluminium folding chair in case they tire, they will. And they are visitors, perhaps a camera, if they're allowed, and pods of film hanging around their necks like garlic wreaths. Visitors come with all manner of expectations, from the sacred to the profane. They come to see something that not everyone will be able to see. One of the wildest of wild, a living Newman. La Mariposa, the butterfly woman. The last event of the day is the butterfly dance. Everyone anticipates with great delight this one-person dance. It is a dance by a woman, and oh, what a woman. So as the sun begins to set, here comes an old man, resplendent in 40 pounds of formal dress turquoise, with the loudspeaker squawking like a chicken espying a hawk. He whispers into the 1930s chrome microphone, "And our next dance is gonna be the butterfly dance." "And our next dance," I don't know why I did that, but it was kind of written like that. Anyway, he limps away on the cuffs of his jeans. Unlike the ballet recital, where the act is announced, the curtains part and the dancers wobble out, here at Puye, as at other tribal dances, the announcement of the dance only precedes the dancer's appearance by anywhere between 20 minutes to forever. Where is the dancer? Tidying up the camper, perhaps. Air temperatures over 100 are common, so last-minute repairs to sweat leaked body paint are needed. If a dance belt, which belonged to the dancer's grandfather, breaks on the way to the arena, the dancer would not appear at all, for the spirit of the belt would need to rest. Dancers delay because of a good song is playing on the radio. Sometimes a dancer does not hear the loudspeaker and must be summoned by a foot runner. And then always, of course, the dancer must speak to all the relatives on the way to the arena and most certainly stop to allow the little nephews and nieces a good look. How awed the little children are to see a towering Katsina spirit who looks suspiciously, a little at least, like Uncle Thomas, or a corn dancer who seems to be strongly resembling Aunt Yazzie. Lastly, there is the ubiquitous possibility that the dancer is still out on the Teskey Highway, legs dangling out the moor of a pickup truck while the muffler smudges the air black for a mile downward. While awaiting the butterfly dance in giddy anticipation, everyone chatters about butterfly maidens and the beauty of the Zuni woman, who danced in ancient red and black garb with one shoulder barred, bright pink circles painted on their cheeks. They laud the young male dancers who dance with pine bows bound to their arms and legs. Time passes and passes and passes. People jingle coins in their pocket. They suck their teeth. The visitors are impatient to see the marvellous beautiful... Sorry. The marvellous butterfly dancer. Unexpectedly then, for everyone is bored to scowls, the drummer's arms begin drumming the sacred butterfly rhythm and the chanters begin to carry the gods for all they are worth. To the visitors, a butterfly is a delicate thing. Oh, fragile beauty, they dream. So they are necessarily shaken out hot when out hops Maria Lujan. And she is a big, really big, like Venus of Windeldorf, like the mother of days, like Diego Rivera's heroic-sized woman who built Mexico City with a single curl of her wrist. And Maria, oh, she is old, very, very old, like women who come back from dust, old like old river, old like old pines of Timberline. One of her shoulders is bare. Her red and black manta blanket dress hops up and down with her inside. Her heavy body and her very skinny legs made her look like she is hopping spider wrapped in a tamale. She hops on one foot, then the other. She waves her feather fan to and fro. She is the butterfly arrived to strengthen the weak. She is that which most think of as not strong. Age. The butterfly. The feminine. Butterfly Maiden's hair reaches to the ground. It is thick as 10 maize sheaves and is stone grey. And she wears butterfly wings, the kind you see on little children who are being angels in school plays. Her hips are like two bouncing bushel baskets, and the fleshy shelf at the top of her buttocks is wide enough to ride two children. She hops, 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 not like a rabbit, but in footsteps that leave echoes. I am here, here, here. I am here, here, here. Awaken you, you, you. She sways her feather fan up and down, spreading the earth and the people of the earth like with the polluting spirit of the butterfly. Pollinating spirit, sorry. Her shell bracelets rattle like snakes. Her bell garters tinkle like rain. Her shadow with the big belly and little legs dances with from one side of the dance circle to the other. Her feet leave little puffs of dust behind. The tribes are reverent, involved, but some visitors look at each other and murmur, "This is it. This is the Butterfly Maiden." They are puzzled, some even disillusioned. They no longer seem to remember that the spirit of the world is a place where wolves are women, bears are husbands, and old women of lavish dimensions are butterflies. Yes, it is fitting that. Wild woman, butterfly woman, is old and substantial, for she carries the thunderworld in one breast and the underworld in the other. Her back is the curve of planet Earth with all its crops and food and animals. The back of her neck carries the sunrise and the sunset. Her left thigh holds all the lodgepoles, her right thigh all the she-wolves of the world. Her belly holds all the babies that will ever be born. Butterfly Maiden is the female fertilizing force, carrying the pollen from one place to another. She cross-fertilizes just as the soul fertilizes mind with night dreams, just as archetypes fertilize the mundane world. She is the center. She brings the opposites together by taking a little form here and putting it there. Transformation is no more complicated than that. This is what she teaches. This is how the butterfly does it. This is how the soul does it. Butterfly Woman mends the erroneous idea that transformation is only for the tortured, the saintly, or only for the fabulously strong. The self need not carry mountains to transform. A little is enough. A little goes a long way. A little changes much. The fertilizing force replaces moving of mountains. Butterfly Maiden pollinates the soul of the earth. It is easier than you think, she says. She is shaking her feather fan and she's hopping, for she is spilling spiritual pollen all over the people who are there, Native Americans, little children, visitors, everyone. She is using her entire body as a blessing, her old, frail, big, short-legged, short-necked, spotted body. This is woman connected to her wild nature, the translator of the instinctual, the fertilizing force, the mender, the rememberer of old ideas. She is la voz mitológica. She is wild woman personified. The butterfly dancer must be old because she resents the soul that is old. She is wide of thigh and broad of rump because she carries much. Her grey hair certifies that she need no longer observe taboos about touching others. She is allowed to touch everyone. Boys, babies, men, women, girls, children, the old, the ill, the dead. The butterfly woman can touch everyone. It is her privilege to touch all at last. This is her power. Hers is the body of la mariposa. La mariposa, the butterfly. The body is like an earth. It is a land unto itself. It is as vulnerable to overbuilding, being carved into parcels, cut off, overmined, and shorn of its power as any landscape. The wilder woman will not be easily swayed by redevelopment schemes. For her, the questions are not how to form, but how to feel. The breast in all its shape has its functions of feeling and feeding. Does it feel? Does it feed? Is it a good breast? The hips, they are wide for a reason. Inside them is a sanity ivory cradle for new life. A woman's hips are outriggers for the body above and below. They are portals. They are lush cushion. The hand holds for love, a place for a child to hide behind. The legs, they are meant to take us, sometimes to propel us. They are pulleys that help us lift. They are anillo, the ring of encircling a lover. They cannot be to this or to that. They are what they are. There is no supposed to be in bodies. The question is not size of shape or years of age, or even having two of everything, for some do not. But the wild issue is, does this body feel? Does it have right connection to pleasure, to heart, to soul, to the wild? Does it have happiness, joy? Can it, in its own way, dance, jiggle, sway, thrust? Nothing else matters. When I was a child, I was taken on a field trip to the Museum of Natural History in Chicago. There I saw the sculptures of Malvina Hoffman, dozens of life-size dark bronze sculptures in a great hall. She had sculpted the mostly naked bodies of people of the world, and she had wild vision. She lavished her love of the thin calf of the hunter, the long breasts of the mother who had grown two children, the cones of flesh on the chest of the virgin, the old man's nuts hanging to mid-thigh, the nose with nostrils bigger than the eyes, the nose hooked like a hawk's, the nose straight like a corner. She had fallen in love with ears like semaphores and ears low near the chin or small as pecans. She had loved each hair coiled like a snake basket, or each hair wavy as ribbon unfurling, or each hair straight as fever grass. She had the wild love of body. She understood the power in the body. There is a line in Tazaki Shang's for coloured girls who have considered suicide when the rainbow is enough. In the play, the woman in purple speaks about having struggled to deal with all the psychic and physical aspects of herself that the culture ignores or demeans. She sums herself up in these wise and peaceful words. Here is what I have. Poems, big thighs, little tits, and so much love. This is the power of the body, our power, the power of the wildish woman. In mythos and fairy tales, deities and other great spirits test the hearts of humans by showing up in various forms that disguise their divinity. They show up in robes, rags, silver sashes, or with muddy feet. They show up with skin dark as old wood or in scales made of rose petal. As a frail child, as a lime-yellow old woman, as a man who cannot speak or as an animal who can. The great powers are testing to see if humans have yet learned to recognize the greatness of soul in all its varying forms. When Wild Woman shows up in many sizes, shapes, colors, and conditions, stay awake so you can recognize the wild soul in all its many guises.